welcome to episode 30 of Season to Taste. It's been so long since we've recorded one of these, we almost forgot how to do the intro there.
Almost like Billy Piper forgetting how to do the voice of Rose in the new Volume 2 10th Doctor Audios, coming soon from Big Finish Productions.
I can't believe you're so obsessed with that based on one tiny trailer.
Anyway, oh, Doctor! Hello!
Anyway, we aren't here to talk about Billy Piper's portrayal of the iconic companion Rose.
Which is going to be brilliant.
We're here to talk... Honestly, I can't believe you're so down on her.
I'm not! Honestly,
she's given up Ibsen to do that. Anyway, what we are here to talk about is the episodes of Doctor Who that we've just watched. For new listeners who may have stumbled across this after our, I don't know, 2-year hiatus... I should explain two things.
Hiatus was longer than Colin Baker's entire era. And had a hiatus in the middle.
And better. Frank, what I was about to say was, I should explain two things. The first is that...
We've made more episodes of this than Stephen Moffat's made of Doctor Who in the last 2 years.
As you can tell, Matt has a lot of pent-up things that he hasn't been able to dribble out onto the podcast over the last 2 years, and now they're all coming out in one foul gush. The two things I was going to say were, firstly, his face now. Firstly, although our hiatus ended recently with the release of episode 29, as we mentioned at the beginning of that, that was actually recorded way back when, and I just managed to finally get it off my old computer and edit it. So this is actually the first one that we've recorded in a long time. The second thing I should explain is this is Season to Taste. The idea is that we work through each year of Doctor Who's long and varied history, picking one representative or not so representative episode to watch and then talk about. Because this has taken so long, we've now actually acquired a number of new seasons at the end. So about half of what we're left with is Capaldi and Matt Smith now, I think. In episode 29, the randomizer decided that we should watch a story from series 5, Matt Smith's first series as the Doctor, and we decided to watch the two-part story, The Time of Angels, and I always want to call it Forest of the Dead, but it's called Flesh and Stone. So, Matt, what did you think about River Who and Bob 2?
Are you leaving that in, or will you edit that?
Edit that out. I spent ages working on that.
Great. I liked it at the time. I still liked it when I watched it this evening. What I particularly liked and what this reminded me of, because I haven't seen one for a while, is just how good Matt Smith was even from day one. Because I think these were the first episodes he recorded. I think he was brilliant in it. By far and away the best thing about it.
Yes, I mean, it helps that he's standing next to River and Amy, so he automatically looks better. But yeah, I thought he's very good when you consider, particularly when you consider that it's the first story that he filmed.
Yeah, I think he nails it straight off. I'm not sure anyone who's come in as the Doctor has had so much to do in their first story and got all of it so right. I mean, I know Davison did Four to Doomsday first, and there are bits of Four to Doomsday where he's notably less confident and comfortable with the portrayal than he very quickly does become. I think Troughton plays around a lot in Power of the Daleks and is kind of a bit oddly, particularly because we've just watched the animation recently, you really notice that Troughton is very backgrounded for quite a chunk of Power of the Daleks, and he kind of noodles around in the background rather than taking centre stage. And I think most of the other Doctors get their kind of post-regenerative trauma in their first episode, so they can play around with it. So it's super impressive how quickly Matt Smith nails it.
I mean, Eccleston recorded Aliens of London first, didn't he? And again, it doesn't feel like it's a sudden change in character in that story, but there isn't perhaps the breadth of stuff that he has to do in that compared to what Matt Smith has to do in this two-parter.
And I think the only other person that comes close to it is McGann in the TV movie, because he really doesn't have... there's no other option.
But even then, he isn't in the first chunk, and then he's wandering around a hospital being weird. So he's only in really the second half where he actually gets to settle down.
Yeah.
Now, I agree that Matt Smith is very good in this. And there is a lot going on. It struck me as we were watching quite how much plot, or at least incident, is packed into it. You have the Angels back, you have River Song, you have Amy with an angel in her eye, you have her crack eating up everything in sight from history, you have the clerics and their kind of concept.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, even though it is a two-parter, there's a lot going on. It doesn't really feel it lets up at any point. It has a real pace to it, and it just keeps throwing things at you. Now, whether it's throwing things at you in a way that you then might not notice, have a chance to question some of those things, but it certainly keeps your interest.
Yeah, rewatching it, I think it's sometimes easy to take the Mickey out of Moffat, because there are tropes and things which he does frequently, which can become a little bit comical. But I think
a lot of them are in this episode.
But I think the script is very clever and well thought through. I think they make the point a couple of times when they're in the labyrinth of the dead that the natives of the planet have two heads. And then, obviously, the statues, which turn out to be weeping angels, have only got one head. But it's there in plain sight.
Spoilers!
Moffat loves hiding things in plain sight, and that's a great example of how he does it. And I think in the second episode, the ultimate way that the angels are defeated is kind of set up from the first moments of the second episode, where the Doctor's talking about gravity and how gravity points towards the floor and how the ship's artificial gravity is still working. And then that ultimately becomes the solution. So it's there again in plain sight. And I think it's just I really like the way that the idea is planted from the very first moment of the second episode.
Now, you've picked two interesting examples there, because the first one, the two-headed aliens, I think is fantastic. It's my favourite thing in the story. It's just the casual way they're talking in what seems to be quite a flippant way about these two-headed aliens, that reminds me, in the way the Doctor's talking, about the Curse of Fatal Death and all the stories about like having dinner with the architect. It has that kind of lightness to it, and then it turns out to be a really important plot point of something which is right in front of them, but also right in front of the viewer, and you're given the information needed to work it out. So I really like that, and it's a really good, strong reveal. I actually don't really like the gravity one, or rather, I have two issues with it. Issue number one is the cliffhanger resolution. I will completely forgive the fact that you don't actually get to see them flying through the cavern in between the cliffhanger and the cliffhanger resolution. I get that would be fiddly to do and not really necessary. But it's really oddly done when Amy's kind of standing there going, well, what happened? And for start, they all seem to have landed feet down, despite the fact they pushed off with their feet. They should all, like, the heads should have just crashed into the thing. And secondly, Amy seems really confused about how she even got there, even though she must have just felt herself fall through.
I don't think that's entirely fair. I mean, she's presumably never experienced artificial gravity like that before and is baffled by what on earth's happening with
confused by how it happened. She generally seems to need explaining to her, for the purposes of exposition, the fact that she's just fallen across the room.
Just typical of her throughout this story.
But then also, the Doctor goes inside the ship and the gravity is pointing in a different direction. As you say, he makes the point about it. He points to the floor. But I don't really understand then why the gravity, there's kind of gravity on the outside of the ship and then the gravity inside the ship is pulling in a different direction. That's just...
No, I think that makes sense, because presumably if someone goes outside the ship to repair it, they want to just be able to walk around the hull of the ship. When they're inside the ship, then they want to be able to walk on the floor.
They have magnetic boots, like everyone has. Anyway, it was a minor niggle where I just thought, that's weird that the gravity's in different directions. Why are you spending energy putting gravity on the outside of your ship? But the other part of it is, yes, the kind of concept of falling is then used against the angels at the end. But it feels like such a, you know, the crack plot, it seems a convenient way of tying it into the season arc and giving a slightly Deus Ex Machina-esque way of getting rid of the angels at the end, which is just there's a big hole and they all fall into it. It's a bit of a flat way of resolving it, I thought.
So I slightly disagree, on the basis that the crack is the kind of ongoing plot arc for the season. And there have been these kind of ongoing plots right from but the Bad Wolf thing in series one. But I think this puts a stake in the ground that actually it's not just going to be a code word or something which has significance in the final episode, that actually Moffat's arcs are going to be a bit more integrated with the whole season. And having the crack, which could easily, had it been in a previous series, just been something that was in the background of the first 11 episodes and then only became significant in episodes 12 and 13, having it play a big role in the first two-parter of the series just ties in with the way that Moffat wants to approach things. So I think in context, given this is Moffat's launch series and given that the crack's been significant in the first episode, I think it's turned up on the outside of the spaceship in the second episode. I can't remember where it is in the third episode, if anywhere.
It's behind the TARDIS, isn't
it? Oh, that's right, at the end. So it's been there. So I think suddenly having it noticeable and people start to comment on it and it be a big thing actually kicks off then the next bit of the mystery is then what caused these cracks? What's it got to do with the date of Amy's wedding? And actually, I think it does progress the kind of season story. So I don't necessarily think it's a flat ending in the context of the 13 episodes. I think
maybe that's
just it, maybe in the context of this one story in isolation, it's a bit more difficult to appreciate. But I don't think it's even in this episode, it didn't really strike me as being the worst thing ever, because there's enough flashback and enough explanation that it doesn't become impossible to get.
It's not that I found it impossible to get, I just think it kind of comes out of, it doesn't really fit with the rest of the plot and it's suddenly there and it's a convenient way to resolve it. However, it's funny that that's your defence of it, because so much of my criticism of this is the opposite, which is that rather than things being coherent and part of a whole broader story that makes sense consistently, there are various things which only make sense or only really fit in the context of this story at the expense of broader consistency. I mean, Riversong is the big one. Riversong's story overall makes no sense whatsoever. And we casually throw in things like, you know, she does the traditional flicking through the diary to see where they are, even though by definition later we're told they go in reverse, they go in opposite directions, she and the Doctor, and therefore there should never be anything in her diary about anything that they're about to catch up with. But there's, you know, the angels are completely changed from how they were in Blink, which is good and bad. You know, there's no point just retreading Blink, but then they're quite elegant, cleverly created, you know, these kind of merciful killers, merciful assassins in Blink. Mm. Now they're doing all sorts of weird stuff. They're in kind of decayed form. Fair enough, that's a slightly different thing, but then they're breaking people's necks. They're talking through them, although I don't understand how the talking through thing works, because you even see Angel Bob later. It's not holding Bob's head. It's not got anywhere to generate his voice from. I can understand the benefits plot-wise of having an angel that can speak, but I don't really understand how it's actually happening. They're now really, really strong. They're like opening doors and things, rather than just like they touch you and suddenly the energy sends you back through time. They're actually like physically beating people up. They seem, they're still very scary, but when they start moving, and particularly that those early reveals where they're suddenly all there, that works really, really well. But it feels like the elegance of them is sacrificed in the name of bringing them back and trying to fit them in another plot. And oh, and all this weird stuff about, you know, if there's an image of an angel, then that's an angel. That, I mean, how does that even work? So there aren't photos in the book because it would be an angel. They're not, that they start to become actual magic at that point.
So I get what you're saying. I think it's not a defence as such, but the same thing happened with the Daleks in the Dalek Invasion of Earth. They get reformatted into something which can become a recurring major villain. Because the Daleks in the Daleks, other than their design being quite cool and their voices being quite cool, aren't really a monster that has any opportunity to come back. Whereas the Dalek Invasion of Earth completely changes their modus operandi, their history, their even slightly their characterisation as
well. I think a lot of it works quite well, but I do the whole, particularly the thing with Amy's eye, basically.
Which never happens in any subsequent Weeping Angel story.
But also, when did we go from, you must look at them, you mustn't blink, to, oh, but make sure you don't look at them in the eye? The idea that, oh, there's somehow inside her and exactly what effect that's supposed to have.
No.
It's basically, it's an entire contrivance to get to the point where she can't see, but she has to be able to see to stop them and create that kind of dramatic moment.
Loves making people blind, obviously.
Well, you are, of course, referencing the end of
Oxygen,
as I'm going to insist on pronouncing it. And it's funny you do that because
This podcast.
Because I was going to bring up Oxygen, because at the beginning of that episode, we get a big lecture from the Doctor about what happens to you when you're in space and how deadly it all is. Whereas in this episode, River can quite happily float out of an airlock with no spacesuit, hang around in space for a bit, her blood isn't boiling, or, you know, all the horrible things that are going to happen. She's not going blind because of the exposure to
sight. The doctor's made oxygen. They specifically reference that in the script. She says, oh, I'll need an oxygen corridor.
But the TARDIS isn't there.
The TARDIS can do things back in time. When it materialises, it's already projecting the oxygen corridor.
I mean, at least have the decency to have the TARDIS materialise first and do that. But anyway, it's not even just an oxygen. You know, you have to have a proper atmosphere and heat and... You know, why not just materialise it at the door?
Yeah.
Why not materialise 5 seconds earlier and just pick her up inside?
Because it wouldn't look as cool, would it? The other thing that I noticed quite a lot when I was watching the episode is how much of a companion piece it is with the two library episodes. So,
I always call it Fires of the Dead because I get the names wrong.
Because this is the first time we've seen River since she was in the David Tennant Silence in the Library Forest of the Dead two-parter. And... barring the first 10 minutes where it's kind of the River Doctor Amy, which maybe we can talk about in a moment because I think those are probably actually the most irritating parts of the entire episode. The first part is River and Co. and a group of explorers poking round a kind of old deserted place and trying to work out what's going on, and there's something... lurking in the shadows. Well, that's very Vashta Narada and the kind of landing party. And then the second part is a race through a forest.
As a load of supporting characters get killed off one by one.
Exactly. And I do think they're very much, much more than any later River story, it's meant to be almost a reflection of the library episodes, re-establishing River's character, reminding people of who she is, and actually using... not the same plot at all, but using the same kind of structure and some thematic links so that the two feel very close together. So I quite enjoyed that, and I think it's explicit when she talks about, ending up in handcuffs as usual, we must stop parting like this, or whatever she says at the end. And obviously at the end of Forest of the Dead, she's handcuffed the Doctor so that she can take his place and kind of save him from having to sacrifice himself. So I think there are kind of some nice melancholy little links back to her death episode, which we've already seen.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't say, apart from getting the name wrong, I hadn't noticed that. I wonder how much it's a deliberate structural reference and how much it's like, that's what happens when you write a two-parter, that you spend a bunch of time, even an old-style Doctor Who story, episode one is wandering around, establishing exactly what's going on, and, you know, episode four is running away and defeating it.
Mm.
I remembered another thing that's one of those annoying inconsistencies, which obviously wouldn't have been apparent at the time this was originally broadcast, which is all that kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink from Bishop Octavian about who River really is, and, you know, oh, if the Doctor found out who you were, he wouldn't listen to you, he wouldn't trust you, so you'd better hope that he doesn't, if he knew why you were in the Stormcage facility. And of course now, well, all those River Song plots are done and dusted, and we kind of vaguely understand that it's because she's some kind of super genetic assassin, Time Lord, daughter version killer, who tries to kill the Doctor but then doesn't. And I kind of think if the Doctor knew all of that, he'd still be fine with it because, you know, at the end of the day, she's Amy's daughter and was programmed and forced into something and then repented. And I wonder at what point Octavian has caught up with this. In fact, I'm not even sure in my head now what point she's imprisoned for it and at what point they all know that it was okay. Is she in prison after she's assassinated him, before she's tried to assassinate him?
So I think...
Well, it's the end of her life, because the last time she...
I think the plot goes, she kills the doctor at Lake Silencio, she gets locked up for killing the doctor, albeit it's actually only the Tesseract thing that she's killed, and she goes to prison, and then she's broken out of prison occasionally, so she's still in the storm cage for killing him at Lake Silencio. She's pardoned at the end of the wedding of Riversong, because the doctor wipes all memory of himself from the universe or something like that. So
the timeline is all messed up yet again.
Yeah, so she's then released, because there's no record of the person that she killed ever having existed. So,
but then you see, she's still in the storm cage at this point.
Time can be rewritten.
And her death's one is the next one. So we shouldn't see any other stories where she's post-Storm Cage, because she's travelling in the opposite... Anyway, let's not...
Well, so I think this thing about travelling in the opposite direction isn't true, is it? Because she gets her Vortex Manipulator, which she uses in every subsequent story in The Pandorica Opens. And then she has that Vortex Manipulator all the way through the next season. So if they're truly travelling in different directions, she should only have it in this story and the Silence in the Library story, and
basically
Pandorica Open. The whole no later stories, which will be earlier for her.
The whole Riversong stuff is look how clever I am, but actually doesn't work if you look too closely at it.
So should we talk briefly about River in this in comparison to her Silence in the Library appearance?
I thought it was interesting that at the start of it, you got those clips of her heels walking along and the lipstick. And actually, obviously, at this point, she isn't someone who turns up like a bad penny every 5 minutes. She hasn't been seen since that point. And so actually, it is a significant reveal as to who this is and what's happening. And it is a strong reintroduction for her. I like that Hello, Sweetie is kind of her version of Mrs. Peel, We're Needed. That she notes down for the doctor to find, although she later even says, "Sweetie, I need you," to him, which is even closer. But yeah, I think it's a good way to introduce her. I find, you know, as soon as she's finding on the TARDIS, she's insufferable straight away. And again, the way that they use metatextual self-knowing, "Oh, you've left the brakes on" type stuff for a cheap gag is kind of amusing in the moment, while at the same time gradually chipping away at the magic of Doctor Who.
Although it does generate the thing that made me laugh the most about the entire episode, which is Matt Smith's noise that he makes if the TARDIS goes...
Yes.
He's just so good.
Yeah, no, he's brilliant doing that, and it is very enjoyable. But at the same time, and it's the same, and we'll come back to this, I'm sure, but it's the same with the scene with Amy at the end. I'm like, this is a really funny scene from Coupling. Unfortunately, it's really uncomfortable in Doctor Who.
Oh, I cut that. The final scene is horrible.
But let's finish with River first.
But River, I agree with you. It's a strong reintroduction. She is obviously the same character as in Silence in the Library. However, the minute she is in the TARDIS and it's just her, the Doctor and Amy, and River's kind of swanning about flying it, she actually, I agree with you, she is annoying and smug. And she's annoying and smug in a way that I don't think she was in the Library episodes. Mm. The Library episodes, it's the same character, but she's not doing that kind of know-all, annoying, smug thing. She's doing the slightly over-familiar with the Doctor, but he has no idea who she is. So it's kind of fun, because usually the 10th Doctor knows everything. So it's placing him in a really uncomfortable position for someone to know more than him. And it really works in that scenario. So I don't know whether it's because she's exactly the same as she is in the Library episodes, but the Doctor's different, and it doesn't quite work for her to be such a smug know-all, or whether she's written as much more of a smug know-all in this one.
I think she comes across as a bit, you know, she is, well, she's not old, she's kind of at the end of her life in that story, and the implication is she hasn't seen the Doctor for a very long time, whereas this is more, she's kind of young and gung-ho. And I think there's an extra, there's a kind of greater vitality to her. She hasn't matured quite as much.
Mm, yeah, maybe that's true.
I mean, she's not as worldly wise.
That's probably true as well. I just found the first 5 or 10 minutes before the church guys turned up, that those were the bits where I found River at her most irritating, because she's swanning around being smug and knowing and doing all the things that she normally does with her diary and things. And Amy's got nothing. Amy's just got petty sarcasm and is trying to rile the doctor and going, oh, is she your wife? And it's just not... It makes Amy look petty and ineffectual in comparison to River. It doesn't make the doctor, I don't think, look ineffectual, because there is just about enough where he still kind of pisses all over her when he opens the door and says exactly what planet it is, where it is, what the weather's like. And there's just enough there where the doctor is clearly a lot better than she is and puts her in her place, but in a really nice way, but in a really clear way, that the doctor doesn't look like a complete loser in comparison to her.
But I don't think she's helped by what I took to be some of the on-location ADR in that first outside scene, where I think some of the later ADR has put an extra edge on her performance that might not have been there at the time. It does what it felt like to me. It's worth noticing, by the way, listener, if you're watching this, watch as the Doctor and Amy leave the TARDIS much later than River, but when it cuts to the outside shot, they're actually way further away from the TARDIS doors than she is, in the way that that's that outside.
Maybe she stops and they kept walking.
But there's not... No, she leaves ages before them, and then they're, like, at the door, and then suddenly there's this scene-setting thing where they're just miles away, and then walking back towards her is if they've gone a really weird loop.
The moment that the bishops turn up and actually River has other people to think about and is responsible for, that actually she becomes a lot more likeable, because she isn't just swanning around being smug. She comes across as scared. She's got a relationship with Octavian there's some tension there.
He's holding something over her.
And I think the moment her hair goes out of the kind of big party hair and gets tied back, she's suddenly much more like, I remember her being in the library, a much more likeable character.
She leaves the ball gown and goes back to the kind of army fatigues.
I like River when she's on the back foot, or she's not the smug know-all, because she actually, for all that she knows a lot about the Doctor, she's not, you know, in charge of every situation that she's in. And I think she's much better in those circumstances than when she's kind of swanning around being all-knowing and smug. And I like it when she's in library mode. I don't like it so much when she's in party mode.
Yeah, and it is. Those are the best bits. I think the period from the bishop and clerics turning up to the end of the first episode, I'd say the strongest part of the story. It has all the angel reveal. It has some nice stuff with the clerics. It doesn't get too much into the technobabble gobbledygook that it does once you're on the ship. It doesn't have all the weird Amy with her eyes closed stuff. Yeah, and we've moved on from the early nonsense about the frozen angel on screen, which is, you know, again, it's effective and scary, but makes just no sense whatsoever.
Well, it's never mentioned again, is it? I mean, the angels never use that MO in any of their later appearances, when they're much more like they are in Blink. So what's the next angel one? The angels in Manhattan. They're just back to sending people back in time and feeding on their life energy, and then I
don't even understand why. And again, yeah, I really like Angel Bob. I like the amusingly flat, matter-of-fact way that he, you know, announces their impending deaths. But I don't really understand what the angel's plan is. I guess to begin with, I thought, you know, he was accidentally giving stuff away. The doctor was tricking him. Then I kind of changed my mind. I thought, okay, fair enough. They wanted the Doctor to do the thing with the ship and release all the energy, and maybe he's not as clever as he thinks he is. But I'm not sure how intentional that was, how strategic the angels really are, and also and really what benefit they have in getting this voice, quite aside from the fact that I don't understand how it works.
No, I'm not sure I do as well. Should we talk about Amy? We've talked about River.
Yeah. So, I mean, Amy is slightly all over the place in this story, because she has her moments of cleverness, or what are taken to be moments of cleverness, like when she puts the video screen on pause. Again, I don't think it makes any sense whatsoever, but in terms of the character, she works it out for herself. She saves herself in that situation and kind of stops it just in time. She has good moments. Again, the complete nonsense with pretending to be having your eyes open later, I think she still comes across as very good in those moments. The weird counting down thing, it creates some dramatic tension, but what possible sense does that make at all? And Karen Gillan does a good job of selling it, but it doesn't mean anything. She has my favourite line, which I hadn't really clocked before. And again, it's as much about dealing with the existing cliche. When they say, Octavian says, "You'd slow us down, Miss Pond." She says, "I don't mean to sound selfish, but you'd really speed me up." "You'd slow us down" is such a cliche of action things. So having someone basically saying, "No, I don't want to be left behind, and you'd really help me if I came with you," is a really nice comeback that I enjoyed hearing from a character.
For me, Amy is really in the shadow of River through the episodes. I get it's reintroducing River. However, I'm not sure River ever works well as a pairing with Amy. But she eclipses Amy pretty much, because the episodes then skew towards being about River and River's relationship with the Doctor.
I mean, is River supposed to be well aware that Amy is her mother at this point?
She must do. I mean, she has to be, right? She's always known that Amy's her mother, and she was Mel's.
And they do have some quite nice moments, where they're hugging after, albeit at the Doctor's instruction, and when she's trying to be supportive of Amy later, where you can kind of read in that River perhaps is treating her like
at some point Moffat told Alex Kingston about River, but I don't know if that was ready for the next series or whether she already knew at this point. But I don't mean that they don't work as two actors together or they don't have nice scenes together. I just mean that any companion in a River song, when River Song's on the scene, is kind of eclipsed by the fact that River Song's on the scene, because the episode's always... because River Song turns up as the companion occasionally rather than being there all the time. The episode's always about, oh, River's in it, and it's a big River episode. Oh, River, River, River. And I just felt like Amy had nothing in the first 10 minutes, bar kind of slightly petty needling and sarcasm for the Doctor, like, oh, you promised me a planet, oh, are you going to get married, oh, heel boy, and things like that, and just being a bit wet and pathetic. And then she just becomes this peril monkey, and I know that's basically the role of companions often, but River doesn't get trapped in a room and get an angel in her eye and then have to be blind, and that River's the one who can repair the teleport and do all the doctory stuff.
The teleport, which is another convenient, just like fix whatever.
But Amy just seems to be a bit useless, a bit whiny. The nadir of it is when she drops the communicator right in front of her. And goes, "Doctor, I can't see it. I can't see it. Where's the communicator? I can't see it. Oh no."
Which is also while talking to him on the communicator, and you're kind of like, well, presumably it doesn't really matter if he can still hear you on it.
I get that it's meant to be a really scary situation, and I understand that it's done for plot convenience.
It is her ankle twist moment.
It just doesn't, I don't think, work. And then the ending bit is
horrible.
And people just keep saying to Amy, oh, you're magnificent, oh, you're great, oh, you're such a genius, and things like that. And I watch it and I think, well, why? There's nothing that she's done that's genius or magnificent. She's just kind of moaning and being a bit shit.
That's why I'm like, does River know you're her mum? Because that's her only excuse for being so overly over the top in her praise for you. I would like to feel that the characters are brilliant because I see them doing something brilliant that I can recognise, not because the other characters are telling me that I have to think that they're brilliant. And they all do it to each other throughout it. They're all slapping their backs and saying that they're geniuses, or they're dumb, or you're so good. You're so good. And actually, I'd rather I drew that conclusion myself and didn't have it rammed down my throat by the characters. It's particularly cringy when the thing that's so good is something that was a load of techno babble, and you're having to rely on, fine, River said it was amazing, whatever you say. But yeah, they really like telling each other how great they are all through this. And obviously, yeah, that last scene, it's just so... It is, again, you took that out and put that in a sitcom, be absolutely fine. It is a funny scene.
Yeah, it is funny.
It's got humorous misunderstandings from a character who doesn't perhaps understand what's going on in the shape of the Doctor. And, you know, amorous intentions out of a Whitehall farce. But, yeah, in a Doctor Who episode, it's just a bit out of
place. It's a bit tacky, isn't it? But, no, I mean, it is just a bit... Bleh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it works.
Some of the other things that I'd noted down. I'm not wild in my trad, old-school Doctor Who fan way that the cliffhanger of the first episode is the Doctor pointing and firing a gun. I know it's a bit sad because it's not like he's pointing it at a person, and it's certainly not like Amy, he's pointing it at a child, but it's still not my preferred Doctor-ish thing. Although I did like he got to do the whole no one puts the Doctor in the corner. He's obviously a big fan of Dirty Dancing. I thought
that's very Silence in the Library as well, isn't it, where the Doctor tells the Vashta Nirada to go and look him up in the books and they all run away. And
well, it's also
he gets his speech here about like there's one thing you never put in a trap. What's that, Doctor?
Yes, I have set up that line very well, haven't I?
And then he does the Stonehenge thing. Like, yeah,
and she's already referring to Pandorica. And then the Pandorica is the trap.
Yeah.
You know, you could argue that's a very clever call forward, or it might just be a slight retread. I thought when they were talking about the timey-wimey gobbledygook, things being deleted, people not remembering, the Doctor casually mentioning the Cyber King just made it sound like Stephen has a complete bee in his bonnet about that episode and somehow, like, really wanted to have a go about it.
Why does no one remember the Cyber King?
Yeah, I was like, whoa, there's not really any need to bring that up, is there? It's such a random... To be honest, none of the viewers probably remember the Cyber King at this point. And they're going, what's he talking about? I thought it was quite appropriate that Amy had the weird thinking her hand had turned to stone bit in a story featuring Ian Glen, whose hand turns to stone in the Game of Thrones.
And as the only other kind of character of note, I do like Father Octavian. I think it's a really nice performance from Ian Glen. And I think the kind of militant church is something that Moffat comes back to again, it looks like, from the trailer for the next episode, that the kind of militant church type thing's coming back, but there's the church military people in the next series in the Good Man Goes to War episode with the clerical marines.
They mentioned the headless monks.
The headless monks.
Or the people at the museum at the beginning of this, and I thought, oh, that's a little reference ahead of time. The other thing was that the angels are scary, and I was reminded watching this.
Oh God, the rotting angels are among the most scary. Just the kind of horrible noseless face. Oh,
but also brilliantly scary. Yeah, they are still as the lights go out and suddenly they're turned and towards. I was reminded particularly because this is about the Byzantium having crashed there. You know, when we went to the crash of the Elysium, punch drunk thing. The best moment in it was being stuck in a corridor with all the other people with an angel at the other end of the corridor and literally the lights going out. And every time the lights came out, the angel had shot down the corridor towards us. And I said, it was a brilliant piece of live theatre, but also it was genuinely terrifying as the lights would come up and suddenly this horrible thing was getting closer and closer. And they are a great invention. They are still scary here, even though they're being twisted and made to do other things and... being used in a different way from how they were used in Blink. They are still a good alien.
As the kind of breakout monster from the new series.
After the Slikine,
obviously. But they are the kind of new series monster which has... It's not at the height of the Daleks, but it's the new series monster that's most
in
classic.
Contemporary awareness. Yeah. I mean, people who kind of have half an eye on Doctor Who... Yeah. You know, watch a bit of such.
They know the Daleks, the Cybermen, and they know the Master Angels. Slash Missy and the Weeping Angels. Those are going to be the main monsters that they think of. So, you know, it's a great achievement that Moffat's got his creation up there in the same kind of breath as the Cybermen and the Master and things like that. The Angels are never consistent, really, from one story to the next. And I guess the Daleks oftentimes weren't consistent one story to the next. But
this is one of my problems with monsters of old is that often they start off really well and they have a really defined USP almost, and then each time they come back it kind of gets weakened because...
Well, the Cybermen are the perfect example, aren't they? The kind of reanimated corpses of dying humans in their first story, and then they just become space robots.
Well, except I think they're more iconic almost as the space robots. I think the best example is actually the Santarans, who basically develop an extra weakness in each of their stories that they can be defeated by. So in the first one, it's kind of the probic vent, and then it's like, oh, but actually, if you overload the
probic vent with energy, then they melt
the shuttle,
Fair, then the next one's the D-Mag gun, which would destroy everything.
But then chronic acid. It's like, why is there a special acid that's particularly bad to the Santarans? Because we don't want to use the probic vent.
The Cybermen are a bit like that. First of all, it's like the power drain of Mondas kills them. Then it's some radiation. Then it's gold dust starts to kill them, and then it's like they're touched by a bit of gold coin or something like that in Silver Nemesis and they die, so they just become progressively
it's like the scratchings from Adric's badge are a bit of different from a glitter gun like covering your systems
and a bit different from Ace firing a silver coin into you, which gold coin sorry into you, which, but I think the Cybermen's whole nature does change. They just become these generic space robots rather than these horrible inversions of humanity that they are in their first story. The Daleks are kind of a weird exception, aren't they? Because even in their first story, most of the elements are there, and then the Dalek invasion of Earth comes in, it reformats them, but it basically just says, oh, they're the space Nazis.
So overall, it's reasonably entertaining.
I think that really undersells it. I think it is very entertaining. It's Matt Smith's first couple of episodes, and he is magnificent. He's like Patrick Troughton meets Peter Davison meets Tom Baker. I think he's just brilliant. Every time I see Matt Smith, having got a bit of distance now from when he was the Doctor, I'm just constantly impressed again by how good he is. I think the story has lots of really neat bits, there's lots of funny lines, there's lots of clever twists. River
I'm not sure there's lots of
really
things.
Irritating at the start, but calms down and becomes quite good. The most disappointing thing for me is just Amy, given it's only her fourth appearance, is so, she's not sidelined as such because she's very central, but she's so weak and pathetic all the way through the story and whiny that
I don't think she's... I think
she doesn't really work for me.
I think that's only... It's, apart from the silly hand thing, it's more the case in the second half, but the problem for me is that so much of her plot is just contrived.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's been shoehorned in rather than coming naturally out of the story, and that she has to be given something to do, and here's some nonsense that we can try to make sense of, but it actually is a...
I think Karen Gillan's very good. Again, it's obviously her first episodes that she recorded as well as Amy, so
she was travelling in a different direction from Matt Smith. She actually did all the others
first. Did the Angels Take Manhattan first,
yeah,
so it's not a comment on her performance, which I think is very good. It's more that I don't think Amy gets very much of worth to do in the episodes, and yet is told how magnificent she is by everyone throughout.
Yes, I do think that it is like everyone's been told you have to give, you know, really positive feedback to everyone in your team, regardless of how bad they've been. Yeah, all the characters come across as like someone's had a word and said, oh, so-and-so's feeling a bit down. You can just tell them they're
magnificent and wonderful.
Yeah. So that was Series 5. There are something like 10 seasons left, mostly recent ones. So let's fire up the randomizer version 2.0, by which I mean I don't have Excel anymore, it doesn't work quite the same way. Randomizer version 2.0 and see where we will go next.
Okay.
Okay, so here's what's left. We can establish exactly how we handle the later ones. So we have not tasted season 1,
mm-hmm.
season 8,
mm-hmm.
season 19, and mm-hmm. all season 21.
Mm-hmm.
And then it jumps to the new series, and we have Series 4,
mm-hmm.
which includes Voyage of the Damned.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have... Now, this is where we might have to decide how to allocate them. So we've done Series 5 and Series 6, and we haven't done anything after that. So currently in the spreadsheet, I mean the randomizer, we have Series 7, including the Snowmen, and then separately we have Series 7B, including mm-hmm. Day and Time of the Doctor. Then Series 8, including, and I've written here, A Very Capaldi Christmas, because I genuinely can't remember what it's called.
Last Christmas.
Ah, okay, Last Christmas. Then Series 9, including the superhero Christmas one, I've written here, because I don't know what that's called either. Oh, Doctor Mysterio, isn't it? and then series 10, including his last one.
Yeah.
That's it. So that's actually, so 7, 7B, 8, 9, 10 is yeah. five series. We have 10 years of Doctor Who in here.
Okay.
And let's fire up the randomizer, by which I mean reopen the spreadsheet. And it has picked season 8.
So that's John Pertwee's second series.
Yeah, so if you don't want to watch a Master story, you're out of luck.
So we've got Terror of the Autons, The Mind of Evil, The Claws of Axos, Colony in Space, and The Demons.
An embarrassment of riches. Not to prejudge, but an embarrassment of riches.
There's not one of those stories that I don't like. So that's good to start off with.
Yeah.
That's good, given it's Pertwee's weakest season, I think.
I'd say season 9 is weaker.
Maybe, but I think Pertwee's performance is stronger in season 9. It's a bit more varied, isn't it?
Well, he hasn't got Delgado every other week.
Yeah, he's not getting pissed off that he's being relegated, yeah.
Well, this is tricksy. I have ideas.
I mean, I'd happily watch any of them. There's none that I would discount out of
Yeah, that's part of my problem. There's none I would go, God, I don't want to watch that. However, there are some I've watched more than others, or at least watched more than others in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely watched The Mind of Evil quite a bit. In fact, did we watch The Mind of Evil at the BFI?
We saw it in colour at the BFI.
Yeah. So that's the most recent one that I've seen. I feel like I've seen Terror of the Autons quite a lot.
I've seen Terror of the Autons quite a lot, but I don't think anyone can ever see enough Terror of the Autons. It's one of the all-time classics, isn't it?
It is, although it's not as good as Spearhead from Space, ironically. I would say. You know, Auton story-wise.
Spearhead from Space doesn't have the Master in it, though.
I like the Master, but that doesn't automatically make it better than Spearhead from Space.
Terror of the Autons is one of those stories which is just... It's just astonishingly... amazing, given it's got the...
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's given the world the CSO kitchen.
It's got the CSO kitchen, it's got that horrible troll doll, it's got the killer settee of death.
He just sit there and
the sofa of
away.
Reasonable comfort.
Yeah.
It's got the Auton policeman that got Barry Letts into a lot of trouble.
It's got the doctor on a
radio telescope. Hundreds of feet above the ground the first time.
It's got a weird telephone cord. It's got Joe Grant's
first story. It's a ham-fisted bun vendor. It's such.
I'm not saying it hasn't got a lot
so
going
much,
for
there's
it.
So much in that. I love Terror of the Autons.
It introduces Captain Yates.
It does.
Yeah. The Mind of Evil I've seen loads. I do feel like I've seen Terror of the Autons a lot though. I've seen Claws of Axos a lot, although not actually that recently. But I think, and I mean, I've seen The Demons a lot as well, and I remember reading, might even be the first novelisation I've read, certainly one of the early novelisations I read was The Demons. But I lean towards Colin Space and The Demons just because I think I've seen them a much longer time ago, Colin Space I've easily seen less than any of the others.
Yeah. I think Terror of the Autons is an amazing reformatting of the series. It's so different from Series 7. It's just Season 7, sorry. It's Barry Letts suddenly going, right, all this kind of olive, uniformed, very realistic, gritty, all of that in inverted commas, by the way, but all of the stuff that Series 7 is famous for gets kicked out and a whole new aesthetic comes in, new companion comes in. It's suddenly a whole new energy for the series, and I think it's amazing. The Mind of Evil is a bit of a Series 7 throwback.
Yes.
But it's really... It's like Season 7 turned up to 11. The Mind Parasite is really kind of quite a creepy monster, I think. And the prison setting's really gritty.
It's got a classic Pertwee-era peace conference.
It's got Pink Dragon. The Claws of Axos, I just remember seeing the photos from that in, I think it was the Radio Times 20th anniversary magazine, and the Axon monsters are one of the monsters like the Yeti from my childhood that were just seared into my brain as a classic monster because of those photos in the 20th anniversary special, because they just looked so weird. And so the Claws of Axos, for me, actually, see when I saw it for the first time and they're inside the spaceship and it's this weird, tenderly, the whole series has this really, such a 1971 aesthetic that is totally unlike anything previously, but also nothing's quite as colourful and exciting in the classic series. Again, I think you don't get anything like Series 8 until you hit Series 1, an Eccleston series that's quite as colourful and comic strip. Then you've got Colony in Space, which is, again, it's a totally different... It's like Doctor Who's come back for the first time since 1969, because it's the first time he goes to space. It's the first time they go to an alien planet. It's the first time you see inside... it's not the first time you see inside the TARDIS, but it's the first time the TARDIS actually goes anywhere, really.
It's Jay's first... In the colour era. Doctor Companion's first trip anywhere.
And I think it gets a lot of bad press, but I think Colony in Space is such a lovely story. And then you've got...
And you get the Master's TARDIS as well.
You do. And then you get the Demons, which is really channelling that whole early 70s kind of Wicker Man, Robin Redbreast, Pendus, Fenn, Blood on Satan's Claw kind of... aesthetic of folk horror. It's
like 2 years before the Wicker Man is doing it.
I think, you know, the Pertwee era in general, I think any sensible person would think is probably one of the strongest runs of Doctor Who ever.
It was very strong and stable.
It's the two. That would be an awful thing to say. But Series 8 is really where Barry Letts and Terence Dicks really come in and make their mark. And when the weakest thing about the series is actually John Pertwee is peeved about playing second fiddle to Roger Delgado and gives a number of very peevish performances, that's the worst thing you can say about Series 8, I think. Katie Manning's great. I think it's just such a good series.
Yeah, that wasn't the question, was it? It was, which one are we going to watch?
Well, I think the so what of that is, I will defer to you, because I will happily watch, I will absolutely happily watch any of them. I love them all.
Well, I think, as I say, I think I'm between Colony in Space and the Demons. I would happily take the opportunity to reevaluate Colony in Space, which I think has the worst rep of the lot. It's got the colony and stuff, it's got the aliens, it's got the Master, it's got the Company, which is perhaps not the very beginning, but it feels like the beginning of a bit of a Doctor Who trope to do with naughty companies. And then you've got the Demons, which was obviously lauded as a classic for many, 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 many years when it hadn't been shown for a while. And it's very good. And I don't know if it's the discontinuity guide. I might be misremembering. I have a memory of someone describing it as one of those where, you know, the cast seem to be having a lovely time regardless of what the... Yeah, and it's not regardless of, because it is a good story, but whether, you know, a lot of the happy reminiscences about came from the cast having a nice time filming it more than it being a strong.
The discontinuity guide's got a lovely turn of phrase. It describes Colony in Space as dreary, muddy and cheap. It talks about Terror of the Autons. I think it's a bit down on. I think in general it doesn't like Series 8 very much, because this was at the point where the whole Pertwee years were going through a bit of a kicking, absolutely unjustifiably. I of those two, if it's either or, my preference is the Demons, because I've seen Colony in Space a couple of times quite recently and I'm a bit more excited about being able to rewatch the Demons.
Well, in that case, maybe it's time to keep our appointment with the Devil's End and watch. That's a reference to the Wicker Man I was doing there.
Understood. My grimace wasn't, because I didn't understand.
Is it because you were picturing the Devil's End?
Devil's Hump.
That's what Pertwee had that season.
Yes.
Yeah, well, let's watch classic Beltane spectacular The Demons.
Huzzah! Can't wait.
So, come back at some point in about 10 years' time for episode 31 of Seasons of Taste, where we will have watched The Demons.
And I'll be talking about it, because Will be dead.
Well, that took a dark turn. Bye.
Bye.